Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ideally, a third of our lives are spent asleep, but some 50 million Americans who suffer from sleeping disorders fall short of that ideal, and the ramifications are more than heavy eyelids the next day. Joining us now by phone from Boston is Harvard Medical School professor and senior physician in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, Dr. Susan Redline. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Researchers have uncovered the mechanism now behind how an animal's biological clock wakes it up and puts it to sleep. The study was on mice, but they say it probably applies to humans. Why is it important for us to understand this mechanism?
Yeah, well, sleep is one of the most fundamental biological processes that is conserved across all species and, of course, is a central feature of the physiology that influences our or human systems, from the way our brain operates to the way we metabolize food. So understanding those mechanisms that initiate sleep and maintain sleep and keep us in a, you know, a daily cycle of sleep and wakefulness that's conducive to good health is really critical.
And so what did they discover recently? What did they reveal?
Well, there's been actually a series of studies that have come out that have really identified molecular clocks in the brain that control and influence when we, when we become sleepy and when we wake up, and have linked those to also molecular clocks really throughout the body that influence how we process food and metabolize our food and so forth.
What kinds of diseases are linked to sleeping disorders?
There's there's a wide range of diseases that are influenced by too little sleep or too poor sleep. So, for example, sleep apnea, which is a condition where we don't breathe regularly at night because snoring interrupts that flow of air in and out and causes our oxygen levels to fall and causes our brain to recurrently arouse at sleep, giving a poor quality sleep. We know can lead to abnormalities in how our body processes sugar and releases insulin, which can lead to diabetes. Those same influences, though, also can lead to surges in adrenaline at both at night and that persist during the day, and that could lead to high blood pressure, and through those mechanisms, increased risk for heart attacks, stroke, and heart failure, and even premature mortality. We also know that getting insufficient sleep through sleep apnea or just sleep deprivation, including insomnia, can lead to problems with processing memories and consolidating memories, learning, as well as to various mood problems.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the importance of sleep today. My guest is Dr. Susan Redline, Harvard Medical School professor and senior physician in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When you were talking about too little versus and too poor of sleep, sleep apnea is often gets the credit or the blame, if you want, if you will, for poor sleep. And a lot of times, that's the kind of sleep that people don't realize they're having. They don't realize they're not sleeping well at night. They go to sleep at night and they wake up in the morning, and between that, they have no memory.
Yeah, so that is one of the challenges of correctly identifying a sleep problem, is that often people are unaware and can't accurately reflect on the quality of sleep that they get. Actually, one of the participants in one of our in our sleep apnea patient-centered network, myapnea.org, that we work with, recently shared with the group that her experience was that patients may a first clue of not getting enough sleep is the inability to recall your dreams. And in her experience, that was the first clue that she had sleep apnea. And what that was telling her was that her sleep was being interrupted at night, preventing her from getting into REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, when she dreamed. So that's actually one subtle sign that's really generated and suggested by patients themselves. But we also know that another clue is just the feeling of feeling refreshed in the morning. And for people who are spending, you know, 7 or 8 hours of time in bed, but wake up feeling they're dragging, that they didn't really feel restored after their period of sleep, and they need a long time getting to go in the morning, is another clue that that sleep quality may not have been sufficient.
How do Americans compare and contrast with the rest of the world when it comes to sleep?
You know, there's actually not a lot of really rigorous data that have used the same methodology that compare people across the world, but there are some trends. So in general, we know that as societies become more developed, more industrialized, that there is really further and further restriction of sleep. In fact, it's been estimated that in the developed world, that over the last 100 years, we've lost for every year another minute of sleep. And that seems to correspond to the increasing 24/7 society, the frequency of shift work, where about 20% of our population are shift workers, the frequent use of social media at night, and just the many, the multiple jobs, the multiple demands in our lives. And the U.S., you know, is amongst the more sleep-deprived areas, but there's increasing data that in Asia, which is rapidly developing and where there are rapid, where there are marked pressures on people to succeed in terms of pressure to get into high-quality schools and the rapid changes in society, that there are many areas in Asia where sleep deprivation may even be worse than the U.S.
When you were describing the kinds of diseases linked to sleeping disorders, some of those I usually and people usually associate with diet, like diabetes. What do we know about that? Are we putting too much emphasis on what we eat and not enough emphasis on how we sleep?
You know, that's an excellent question. And I think often when we think of health behaviors and health lifestyle, we think of nutrition and physical activity. However, it's become increasingly clear that that third leg of the stool is sleep. And in fact, sleep probably interacts quite closely with those other two legs of health, and in particular with nutrition and diet. So, for example, we now know that it's not only what you eat that counts, but it's when you eat that counts. And in fact, if you eat at times when you should be sleeping, you're less likely to metabolize your food and more likely to gain weight. Likewise, we also have found that people who don't sleep enough, people who get less than 6 hours, adults who get less than 6 hours of sleep a night, for example, are more likely to crave high carbohydrate, high fat, dense foods. And over time, we know from very good literature that people who are getting less than 6 hours of sleep a night are more likely to be obese and gain weight over time. So insufficient sleep is a real trigger for various obesogenic behaviors and can, you know, lead to obesity per se, as well as independently, may also lead to problems with the pancreas functioning well and insulin resistance that can lead to diabetes.
Do we know if physicians, when they're working with patients who are struggling with their weight, whether it's obesity or near obesity, do we know if physicians are saying, "Are you getting enough sleep?"
I hope so, but I think the suspicion is that this the awareness of the link between obesity and sleep is still a link that's that particular piece of information is still getting disseminated. And I think that in general, the concern is there's a lot of focus on calorie and intake and not enough about integrated health behaviors that include sleep. Now, I am aware that there are some emerging weight loss programs that now are including sleep as part of its education curriculum and part of its approach. And there's some preliminary data, for example, from weight loss programs, that those people who are in those programs who are getting insufficient amounts of sleep are those people who are less likely to lose weight in the program, and even more so, are more likely to gain weight when the program is over.
What happens to your brain if you don't get enough sleep?
That's a great question. And recently, one of my colleagues, a new neurologist at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Ina Donjelic, wrote a piece on one of our patient blogs on myapnea.org, specifically discussing the cognitive effects of poor sleep. And your listeners may want to take a look at that, because that really goes into these mechanisms nicely. But in general, what we do know is that sleep is really critical for different aspects of learning and consolidation of specific aspects of memory. And insufficient sleep interferes with that process of really consolidating memory, and such that we, even if we have been exposed to material during the day and we think we've learned it, if we haven't actually had a good night's sleep, we're less likely to put it into permanent memory stores.
Now, is this something you tell your students when they're preparing for a test?
Absolutely. And I tell it to my children as well. And I think we know very commonly that students like to do all-nighters. And one of the real problems of those all-nighters is what they've studied that night before. If it did not follow a period of, 6 to 8 hours of sleep, that material is often lost.
Right. So maybe you can pull an all-nighter to finish a paper, but not necessarily before to study for a test.
Yes, and the quality of the paper could be questionable too, because again, as you become more and more sleep deprived, your attention, you'll have attentional lapses, you'll have delayed reaction time, and you're less likely to process information in a flexible, creative, efficient manner.
Now, when we're talking about sleep, are we talking about that nice 8 hours of sleep as a general rule of thumb?
That's correct. There's been a fair number of recent reports that have looked at normative data, and in general, the data suggests that in adults, that between 7 and 8 hours of sleep is the magic number where, in general, the population seems to function best. Now, we know that there are some people that need some, a bit more sleep than that, and some people that seem to get away with a little less, but that's really the magic number we aim for. Now, it's important to note that children need more sleep, of course, and sleep needs then, from infancy through adolescence do change. And in particular, teenagers, for example, need a little more than 9 hours of sleep a night. And of course, we know that that is actually really attained in this group of people.
There is an accumulative effect, too, because of that plaque buildup that occurs in the brain. If you go long periods of time with sleep deprivation, even if it's minor, seemingly minor, it can affect you long term.
Yeah, I think you're referring to some very, very exciting work that's come out that's shown that, in fact, it's during the time that we sleep at night that the specific systems in our brain that are responsible for filtering out toxic metabolites, including those proteins that accumulate in diseases, for example, like Alzheimer's disease, that they actually are normally filtered at night during sleep. And now the concern is, based on some animal models and some emerging data from humans as well, is that perhaps that chronic insufficient sleep interferes with that normal filtering process that our body undergoes to get rid of those excess toxins that, when they do build up, can interfere with, the function of the brain, its ability to communicate, the ability of those synapses to work appropriately.
Well, we are out of time, but Dr. Susan Redline, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your interest in sleep, and sleep well.
Dr. Susan Redline's a Harvard Medical School professor and senior physician in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Coming up, more Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. You've heard the expression to talk turkey, that is to speak plainly and to the point. Today we're talking turkey about turkey and its nutritional benefits. Joining us now is nutritionist and host of the Nutrition Diva podcast, Monica Reinagle. There's a link to her podcast on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Monica, welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be with you again.
You just returned from Ohio, where you visited a turkey farm. What brought you out there or out here?
That's right. I was just in your backyard up there in Northwest Ohio, and I was out there for a fascinating tour of the turkey industry that was hosted by the National Turkey Federation. They are, not surprisingly, trying to raise awareness of turkey as a great source of lean protein and a very sustainable agricultural product. And wow, I learned so much about turkey. I visited one of your great family farms there in Ohio, Cooper Farms, mm-hmm. who have been raising turkeys for three generations. But it was a great trip. And we also had an opportunity, some wonderful chefs that are hidden gems in Ohio, Aaron Weibel of the Sweetwater Chop House up in Defiance, Ohio. And Michael Delegata of Michael Anthony's in Versailles cooked us some fantastic tasting menus featuring turkey. So I really had a great time in Ohio these last 3 days. So thanks for hosting there. Thanks to your state for hosting.
So what did you learn?
Well, I knew that turkey was a great lean protein source. I guess what I really took away from it was the fact that we undervalue turkey. You know, we tend to think of it once a year, right, on mm-hmm. Thanksgiving, and maybe at the deli counter when we're getting our sliced lunch meats. But as somebody who develops a lot of recipes and talks a lot about healthy eating, I definitely have to admit that turkey does not come to mind, and it should, because it's really versatile, really easy to work with, very affordable, and probably deserves a little bit more of my attention and everybody's attention. But it was also just great to be on, I live in a city on the East Coast, and it was wonderful to see the people who are every day producing our food and the care that they put into it. Right now, there's an enormous concern about avian influenza, mm-hmm. and I was so impressed by the biosecurity measures that they have in place. We visited about six different facilities, and I think I've seen operating theaters that weren't uh-huh. as clean and well protected. So they're doing a great job up there. But I did come home sort of with a renewed appreciation for how much more I could be doing with turkey than I am. So that was lots of fun.
For a lot of people, they worry about poultry and how they're housed.
Well, yeah, actually, I'm glad you mentioned that. I live in Maryland, which is a big chicken-raising state, and there is a lot of concern about the animal welfare of chickens. And one thing that I learned in the last few days is that all turkeys are cage-free. Just because of the size of the bird, they cannot confine them in small spaces, and that's one of the things that people have concerns about chicken, that they are, packed in, that they don't have enough room. And turkeys are all cage-free, whether you're paying extra for that or not. So they live in very comfortable, clean, spacious barns where they're kept very comfortable and safe from predators. So it was nice to see that we can enjoy turkey without feeling like we're earning bad karma.
We take for granted chicken eggs, but why don't we have turkey eggs? Did they talk about that?
We all asked that, and we saw some turkey eggs, and we actually saw them being hatched, ooh. Which was amazing to see those little chicks coming out. And of course, they were just cute as all get out. They the You could eat a turkey egg, and apparently they're wonderful for making egg noodles and other kinds of pasta because you get a really rich yellow color from them. And they're perfectly nutritious. The reason that we don't eat them is purely a matter of cost effectiveness. It would just cost too much. Gary Cooper, who is the COO of Cooper Farms, told me that he'd probably have to charge about $20 a dozen for turkey eggs because of, you know, the realities of that agriculture. So I think that's why we don't eat turkey eggs.
Okay. Well, and how does the nutritional value of turkey compare to chicken?
You know, it's actually a little bit higher in protein, a little bit lower in fat. Of course, it depends on which cut. In all poultry, the dark meat is going to be just a little bit higher in fat, but also, as a result, a little moister, a little more flavorful, and even with the dark meat, still a very nice lean protein that is lower in saturated fat than a lot of than the red meats, of course. But, you know, it's even a little bit leaner than chicken. But, you know, fat is not really the enemy. You know, it's not about necessarily eliminating all the fat from the diet. For me, it was more about, well, this is a way to put more variety in the diet. This is, you know, something that we could be using just to mix it up a little bit so that we're not overly reliant on any one source of animal protein.
Okay. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about good nutrition with my guest, Monica Reinagle. She's a nutritionist and host of the Nutrition Diva podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Monica Reinagle, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@WOSU.org. I was really interested in your column that I read about coffee as health food. And I actually read the column you had in response to somebody who accused you of being bought off by the coffee industry. You were ticked, Monica.
Well, I did lose my temper a little bit, only because this is such a frequent thing that, you know, there's certainly in the field of nutrition and nutrition research, reasonable minds can sometimes look at the same data and come to different conclusions, and that's all, you know, well and good that we can discuss those things, but yeah, if somebody doesn't agree with my interpretation and they say, oh, well, you're just saying that because somebody's paying you to say it, I do take that a little personally. but the real point of that column was, yes, there was two more recent findings on coffee, and I had to laugh when I was listening to your conversation with Dr. Redline about sleep.
Yes.
Sort of the other half of the coin, because caffeine, of course, is a stimulant, and we do want to be careful with our intake of caffeine so that it's not interrupting our sleep, because I agree with Dr. Redline 100%. You know, it's such, and I think of sleep as another nutrient. I call it vitamin Z, right? Mm-hmm. But as long as you're not interrupting your sleep quality, caffeine really does have a growing list of well-demonstrated health benefits for the brain. You were just talking about brain health, and it appears to be neuroprotective and to reduce the risk of a lot of brain disease, to protect cognitive function, actually, as we age. But the most recent finding had to do with colon cancer, and those people who have had colon cancer and they've survived colon cancer who drink coffee regularly, you know, they said in the study 4 cups a day, but they were talking about very small cups. It was really about, well, really one of the large sizes from Starbucks would be all it would take, that they had a significantly reduced incidence of their cancer recurrence, which is huge. So it's just another finding in a long list that coffee really does seem to have a lot of biological and neurological benefits. And I'm a fan.
Is there any clue to the mechanism of how coffee reduced risk of cancer recurrence?
They did not discuss that. It may or may not have to do entirely with the caffeine. Now, this study did find specifically that it was people drinking caffeinated coffee that had that benefit. So the caffeine may play a role, but there are a lot of other volatile acids in coffee that we know are bioactive, and so there could be a synergistic effect. That's something that we're still trying to untangle, both on the relationships between coffee and cancer, also between coffee and diabetes risk. It appears to, there's something in there that appears to improve our ability to regulate our blood sugar. And then, of course, I guess it's no big surprise that some of those substances would have neurologically active properties, because we can feel that. We can feel the neurological effect when we have a cup of coffee. It wakes us right up. So, but coffee is a very complex substance. There are lots and lots and lots of chemicals, natural chemicals in coffee. So it'll be a little complicated sorting out who does what. But, you know, the object here isn't necessarily to extract something and turn it into a pill. Mm-hmm. We can enjoy it as a food, and that's always great when food can be our medicine.
One thing is about coffee and how much they consume. We think it's determined in terms of 8 ounce cups or 6 ounce cups, but most of us mm-hmm. don't drink that small. We don't think of a cup that way when it comes to coffee, do we?
Right. Most of, if you're drinking a mug of coffee, that is usually equivalent to about 2 of what a researcher would consider a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
So sometimes that can get a little tricky when you're interpreting that science to translate the amounts that they're talking. It's similar to the way researchers talk about alcohol. And, you know, when they talk about how many drinks a day are associated with either benefits or risks, and they'll talk about, you know, women shouldn't have more than 1 drink a day on average. But what they don't tell you is that they are counting 1.5 ounces of spirits as a drink. And if you go out and have a margarita or a martini mm-hmm. at happy hour, you may be consuming 2 or 3 drinks. So it's a little bit similar. Sometimes those researchers have standardized units that aren't always what our sort of cultural norms are.
Right, because at any good Mexican restaurant, it's a jumbo margarita during happy hour is what the deal is.
If it doesn't come in a fishbowl, I'm not interested.
Okay, so skipping breakfast, I've talked about this with other people, other advocates of it. Breakfast has traditionally been thought of as, you know, the most important meal of the day.
Yeah.
A recent study, though, has shown that it might be beneficial for some, especially people trying to lose weight.
Yeah, this got a lot of people up in arms and into the debate again mm-hmm. about breakfast. And we have this longstanding orthodoxy that if you skip breakfast, you know, that this is going to sabotage your weight loss efforts. And this was a study which tested this effect. It was a pretty small study. It was about 3 dozen women who needed to lose some weight, and a third of them ate oatmeal for breakfast, and a third of them ate, like, Frosted Flakes or something like that for breakfast.
Which is ridiculous, but yeah.
Right, and then a third of them ate no breakfast at all, and at the end of the study, the only group that had lost any weight were the ones who had skipped breakfast. So it was just another questioning that infallible rule that skipping breakfast is invariably going to lead to weight loss. And I think, actually, and we've talked about it on Wellness Wednesday mm-hmm. before, mm-hmm. because this has been a theme that I've been talking about a while. And basically, my point of view is that if your total intake over the course of the day is balanced, is nutritious, is the right amount of calories for you, I'm prepared to be pretty flexible about when you want to eat it. And if your biology or your schedule just means that you're not hungry in the morning, or you don't get hungry till 10 or 11 o'clock, that's fine with me if you want to skip or delay your breakfast, as long as that breakfast when you do, or that first meal of the day when you do eat it, is still a healthy one. I think where this goes wrong is that people aren't hungry, they leave the house without eating, but they also leave the house without a plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then at 10:30 or 11, they're starving, and they end up making poor choices, and they're having a donut or, you know, something else that wouldn't be consistent with a healthy choice. That problem wasn't so much because they skipped breakfast, but because, you know, they didn't have a plan for having that healthy meal available to them when they did get hungry. So
I found that if I eat especially any kind of big breakfast in the morning, which isn't typical on a weekday morning anyways, but it affects my, I have to have the adrenaline going at 10 o'clock in the morning here.
Right, you need to be on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just have a piece of fruit.
Oh, so you find that you are more sluggish if you eat breakfast?
Yes.
that's, you know, you're not the only one. I actually find if I eat breakfast, especially the kinds of breakfast that they fed these poor study subjects, you know, bowls of cereal, I'm hungrier.
Yeah.
I, you know, eating breakfast actually makes me hungrier. And I have to admit, I'm kind of a breakfast skipper. I usually eat my first meal of the day pretty late in the day, about 11 o'clock. But I do try to make it a healthy one. A lot of people wrote into me after I talked a little bit about that breakfast study saying, yeah, but what would have happened if they'd given them a high-protein breakfast? And that's a very valid question. You know, the three options were no breakfast, a high-carb breakfast, and a higher-carb breakfast. And it was perfectly valid to wonder, what might have worked even better or equally well was a higher-protein breakfast. And, you know, I would have to agree.
Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. You skipped breakfast. Hi.
Howdy. Yes, I've been skipping breakfast for almost a year now, and I've found it to be extremely beneficial, not necessarily just for weight loss, but just for general overall well-being. I've gained a lot more energy, especially in the morning, definitely in the afternoon. You know, I don't have those at 3 o'clock downer that I used to have. I drink a lot more water during the morning hours to kind of supplement the fact that I'm not doing an intake, so I try to kind of ease the pain of not having food, and I'm more hydrated, and I feel a general overall better health. I used to get headaches practically once or twice a month, and I don't get those anymore.
So Dan, what is your first meal of the day? Do you wait till lunch to eat?
I wait until I try to wait until about 12:30, and I usually stop eating by about 9:30, possibly 10 if there's something going on that evening.
Mm-hmm.
I did start it for, you know, weight, for kind of to look into this as a weight loss option. And I have lost some weight over it. I or at least stabilized, and now I'm stabilized. I don't see
well, you know, you may have stumbled across Dan, I'm sorry to interrupt. You may have stumbled across another important key here, because it sounds like if you're not eating till 12 and then you're stopping at 9 or 9:30, then you have only about 9 or 10 hours a day that you're eating. That's something that we call a restricted eating window.
Hmm.
And there's also been some research showing that people who eat the same amount of food, but they compress it into a shorter window, exactly as you're doing, lose weight relative to people who eat that number of calories spread out over 12 hours or 14 hours. So that's very interesting. That may have been another little piece of that for you. But and as we've talked about, you know, there's no one-size-fits-all. It's about finding what works for you. And, Dan, that sounds like that's working for you.
Yeah, thanks, Dan, for that call. I appreciate it. Gosh, I tell you, the human body's an amazing thing, isn't it, Monica?
It's incredibly flexible and adaptable. That's for sure, which is why we can find so many different ways to maintain wellness. We don't all have to march to the same drummer.
Well, Monica Reinagle, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
I always enjoy it, and we'll talk to you next time.
That's Monica Reinagle, nutritionist and host of the Nutrition Diva podcast. We'll have a link to that podcast, pardon me, on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Martial arts are familiar to many as a form of combat, but they also can be used to stay in shape. Joining us now by phone is author and martial arts and fitness coach, Phil Pierce. His many books on martial arts and fitness include Fighting Fit, Your Ultimate Martial Arts Fitness and Exercise Guide. He joins us from the UK. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Are there so it seems like so many different kinds of martial arts. Can you tell us about some of the more popular ones for fitness?
I mean, martial arts is a massive category, of course, and technically any kind of combat art, anything that involves learning to defend yourself or any kind of skill for combating against someone else is a martial arts, and it goes back thousands of years. If we're talking modern arts, you'd really break them into probably two kinds of categories. You've got what you probably call traditional arts, which is the old white pajamas, sitting in a gym in rows, earning belts and doing things with patterns, that kind of thing. That's traditional styles that you would think of, like karate, taekwondo, kung fu, Chinese and Japanese styles. The other side of that, what's becoming very popular today, is what's generally termed as modern martial arts. These are styles that haven't really been around that long, but are getting very, very popular because of the fact that they can teach you to defend yourself, but they also teach a good level of fitness. If you do want to defend yourself, then being fit is absolutely crucial. And those would be probably styles like Krav Maga, any of the reality-based self-defense, Sistema, even mixed martial arts is becoming incredibly popular now as well.
How do you know which one to choose when it comes to martial arts and fitness?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people actually ask me that, and it's a really interesting question. The fact is, people often say to me, which is the best martial art? And I always say, well, which one's best for you? And that's really what it ultimately comes down to. You have to ask yourself what you want to get from a martial art. For me, anyway, it's been a personal journey, and it literally turned my life around. I think I may have mentioned before in my books, for example, that I was jumped when I was quite young in my teens, and I got beaten up and I was put in hospital in a not very good condition. And then I took up martial arts after that. And for me, it was more about building confidence. It was that was purely to get me out of the house and build a bit more confidence back. Over the years, I've developed so much more from it. I've developed self-defense ability, fitness and awareness and confidence and all sorts of things. And obviously now I'm writing about it as well. But the individual, the person on the street, it comes down to what they want from it. If they really are focused on fitness, then there's going to be some styles that are more heavy on that. If you are traditional, then Shaolin styles of Kung Fu are going to be pretty heavy on fitness. But if you are just looking for a club environment, some camaraderie, then probably any of them are going to be good for you. But again, it could be you really want to do sport. Maybe you want to compete, in which case a lot of the Taekwondo and Karate styles really have massive national tournaments, which are a lot of fun. And they're worth checking out as well. So you really just have to ask yourself, what do you want to get from it? And I guarantee that if you try and find out somewhere locally that offers that, you'll have a lot of fun when you do.
You know, I think about Keanu Reeves in that scene in The Matrix where they download jiu-jitsu and he goes, I know jiu-jitsu. You know, it's a little more complicated than that, isn't it?
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, I think that film alone has probably spawned thousands of martial artists back in the late 90s. But yeah, it is obviously, of course, a lot more complicated than that. But it can be simple as well. It really depends what you want to take from it. You can dedicate your whole life to martial arts, and I never intended to, but that's how it's ended up with me. But I always think of it as more of a journey than a destination. It's a bit of a cliche, perhaps, but if you're focused on a specific outcome in martial arts, that's fine. But for most people, it's the act of going along, seeing people that you have fun with, learning new skills, and getting fit along the way. And that's the real good side of it for me.
What are some of the core exercises for upper body strengthening when it comes to martial arts?
Well, there's a few misconceptions, actually, when it comes to martial arts as to what works really well. The natural assumption for most people would be that arms and legs are the striking tools, of course, with punches and kicks. And everybody thinks, well, I need to work on my arms and legs for developing power in those. And they do have a small effect on them, but core power and strength from the center of your body, your chest, your abdomen and your lower back is actually where the power comes from in punches and kicks. So that's really where you need to develop first. I mean, you look at that like the foundation of your body. So once you've got a strong core, strong upper body and core, then you can work on the arms and legs. The arms in particular, a lot of people assume as well that you see these guys down the gym working out, getting massive biceps, for example, and their biceps just help you pull your arm back. They don't actually help you make a punch anyway. So these guys with massive biceps probably aren't going to be that effective at punching unless they've worked triceps, so what's called an antagonistic pair. So there is a few misconceptions there, but the classic exercises that everybody knows are just you know, they're classic for a reason. They've been around for a long time and they work. So core strengthening exercises are going to be your push-ups and sit-ups, back raises, even something low impact like plank or holding positions like that for a long time can help develop core strength. That's where the power comes from in those sort of styles.
We're talking about martial arts and fitness with martial arts and fitness coach Phil Pierce. He's written books on the topics, including Fighting Fit, Your Ultimate Martial Arts Fitness and Exercise Guide. If you have a question or comment for Phil Pierce, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Phil Pierce, why do they call them martial arts?
Well, in the modern day, it has a certain different connotation compared to how it would have done in the old days. People think these days you say martial arts and people automatically assume it's the style of karate or taekwondo or standing around in the gym wearing white and punching in rows. But realistically, it goes back to martial times, times of warfare, thousands of years ago even, where there were techniques for unarmed combat. That's all it comes down to, really. Skills that were passed on through generations for dealing with people when you didn't have a weapon in hand. And that's realistically what it is. You can trace martial arts as a combat style back to ancient Egypt or medieval knights. Even those sort of days, they had documented scripts for how to deal with people when you don't have weapons in hand. And so it's really just martial style, unarmed warfare almost, although most people try not to make it warfare these days. That's the principle behind it.
You mentioned earlier mixed martial arts. So there's traditional and mixed martial arts. What is the difference? It's just a kind of a buffet from different arts or what?
Yeah, that's a pretty good analogy. Mixed martial arts has become probably the most popular modern style of martial arts of the last few years, especially with big names making a lot of money in the movies as well. You've got people like Ronda Rousey and Anderson Silva in UFC as well, winning a lot of matches and making a lot of money and getting on TV. Mixed martial arts originally came about quite a few years ago as a way for people to test which martial art would be more beneficial against the next. Everybody, as long back as history has existed, has been debating, you know, is karate better than kung fu? Would my style beat yours? Can my dad beat up your dad? That kind of argument, really. And as time's gone on, they decided, well, really, we need to find this out. And so back in the 80s, competitions were set up to matched, say, karate guys against bare-knuckle boxers and things like that. But what came about was quite interesting is that they realized in that environment, in the ring, when there's two guys and they can use any style they want, there was really only two or three styles that came out most effective for that scenario. Now, I'm not saying those are the best techniques of all or that they're the best martial arts styles, but they are probably the most effective in that scenario. And what happened was that the karate guys and the taekwondo guys were doing okay, but the Thai boxers, the guys using the close-range knee strikes and all that sort of stuff, were absolutely dominating when they stood up. And then the Gracie family from Brazil came along with all these crazy locks and popping people's shoulders out and all that sort of stuff, and they sort of dominated for a while, and everybody thought, well, let's just combine those two. And then nowadays you tend to get most people are stand-up strikers, which are Thai boxing, mm-hmm. and on the ground they tend to use a lot of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. But there's a lot of gyms now which train purely MMA, so it's a big mixture of standing up fighting and grappling fighting as well. It's quite interesting, good style to give a go if you get a chance to train in it. The only downside, I would say, is the competition is a bit brutal. So if you do value your face, you might not want to get pummeled in the face every day. So.
Which answers my next question a little bit. What kind of injuries you should look out for? But what kind of injuries should beginners in martial arts fitness look out for?
Flexibility is probably the one that they work quite a lot with when you're starting out in martial arts. And that's what you need to be aware of in terms of fitness, because as a beginner, you're not going to be that flexible. Your muscles won't be all that warm or used to flinging your legs around. So you do need to make sure that you warm up properly. You do stretch as the instructor suggests, and you don't just try throwing yourself around like a crazy thing. I've seen a few injuries of people pulling muscles, snapping muscles, and it's not very nice, really.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the actual chance of of getting hit or getting injured in terms of someone kicking or punching you in the face or something like that is actually quite low until you get to a higher level, until you get to a competition level.
Well, In the process of your experience as a coach, can you explain why men seem to be so much less flexible than women? And is, does that become obvious in martial arts, for, as far as beginners go?
Yeah, it does somewhat. I mean, the genetics play a big role in things. It is quite galling, to be honest, when I look at myself, and I've done 15, 20 years of martial arts, and then some 16-year-old girl will show up at a class and can do the split straight away, and I'm like, it's really not fair. But I think, yeah, genetically, there's always going to be a difference between men and women, and men are built naturally taller and slightly more muscular, and women generally have better flexibility. Although, that said, I have seen some guys that are incredibly flexible as well, so, you know, you can't paint everyone with that brush, but that's probably comes down to genetics more than anything, yeah.
But it's something that with time and work, you can at least overcome some of it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I am way, way more flexible than I used to be. Everybody's got limitations, and there's an old rule that you should sort of push your limitations but not break them, as it were. If something hurts you, for example, I use a rule of like a 1 to 10, where 10 is absolute agony and 1 is where you don't feel anything at all. Around the 6 or 7 mark is kind of okay. That's where you're pushing your tolerance, where something is a bit sore, it's a bit painful, but it's not going to cause injury. Once you're getting into 8, 9, and 10, that, you know, avoid that area, especially with stretching, because that's where you can lead to snaps and long-term injuries. But, yeah, training regularly, regularity is absolutely important, but that can definitely improve flexibility. And everything impacts, of course. Regularity comes down to fitness and everything else as well. It helps all your skills.
You know, many martial arts are famous for their high-kicking techniques. You've referred to them a little bit. Are there certain stretches you should do beforehand when it comes to those kinds of kicking?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Over the last few years, a lot of research has come out that traditional stretching, what they call static stretching, which is the kind... When I was at school, anyway, this is the only kind of stretching we were told, where we'd get a gym teacher who would take us into a cold field somewhere, and we'd have to bend our legs one way, and then he'd ask us to hold our leg in a position and just stretch it as far as we could. But static stretching has actually been shown to reduce power, actually. It's been shown to be quite bad for the muscles. What's the optimal way nowadays is what most people suggest, anyway, is active stretching, or basically doing the activity that you do normally, but at about 10% intensity.
Okay.
So it's a very low-level intensity. So leg swings, for example, are a classic martial art exercise, whereby you have one leg back, one leg forward. Trying to keep the back leg straight, you just swing it straight up and down again. And you do, say, 10 of those, and on 8, 9, and 10, you should be aiming to get about your own head height. Now, of course, those are actually moving the muscles around, which is really useful. If, for example, you were just standing with your feet together and went down to bend and touch your toes, that's a static stretch, and that's not so effective. In fact, it's been shown that it can actually reduce power. But, yeah, leg swings out the front, out to the side as well, keeping the leg straight. That's the classic stretch. What's called a V-stretch as well, in terms of leg stretching anyway, where you put your legs in a V-shape as you sit on the floor, and then you reach your arms out in front, or you reach your arms down to the left leg or the right leg, and try and get your head onto your knee or as far down as you can, and then you'll hold that. That's more of a static stretch again, but that is a bit of a classic stretch you'll find in stuff like taekwondo and karate. Those are good ones for after you've done a bit of running around and a bit of warming up. And they really help flexibility long term.
We're just about out of time, but I did want to ask you about the underlying philosophies of most martial arts. They exist, Buddhism, Taoism. You know, do these philosophies help guide a person's fitness? Are they part of the equation for you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can go into martial arts without any kind of guiding philosophy or any principles behind it. Most the modern styles, pure self-defense ones, don't really look at that aspect. But I quite enjoy the traditional arts because they do include that moral aspect, the towers behind them, if you like. And yeah, there is definitely a philosophy behind it. They all have their own tenets, usually involving humility and integrity and certain determination and perseverance. Each style will be different, but if you look to them as a guiding rule, they are a really good way to help push you through your training. And they'll, in fact, ask you about those sort of things if you do the belt grade in a lot of the traditional styles. So it is worth looking into. The history and the tenets behind them are quite fascinating in a lot of cases.
Phil Pierce, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
Phil Pierce, he's a martial arts and fitness coach. He's written several books on martial arts and fitness, including Fighting Fit, Your Ultimate Martial Arts Fitness and Exercise Guide. Thanks for listening, and thanks to the AllSide staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shia Lanat. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks again for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.